This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Charlize Theron, plays Megyn Kelly in the new film Bombshell. It's based on the story of how Fox News host Gretchen Carlson sued Roger Ailes in July 2016 for sexually harassing her. Within days, Megyn Kelly, who was then a Fox News host, and several other women at Fox came forward with their stories about Ailes. A couple of weeks after Carlson filed her lawsuit, Ailes was forced to resign from his positions as chairman and CEO of Fox News. Carlson is portrayed by Nicole Kidman in the film. John Lithgow plays Ailes. Some of the characters in the film are fictional. Theron is one of the producers of the film. She grew up on a farm in South Africa during the apartheid era. In her late teens, she came to New York and studied at the Joffrey School of Ballet. After injuries put an end to her dream of becoming a ballerina, she turned to acting. In 2003, she won an Oscar for her starring role in Monster as a prostitute and serial killer. In the post-apocalyptic action film Mad Max Fury Road, she played Furiosa, who rescues young women from the villain who's keeping them as slaves for breeding children. In Young Adult, she played an author of popular young adult novels who's in her 30s but has the emotional maturity of a teenager. In the film Tully, her character was overcome by postpartum depression. Let's start with a clip from Bombshell. This is just after Gretchen Carlson has sued Ailes, alleging she was fired from her program for refusing Ailes' sexual advances, which he denied at the time. Megyn Kelly is talking with people who work on her show who were reading tweets about Carlson's allegation, including this tweet from Fox News' Britt Hume.
Why didn't Gretchen quit and sue instead of suing only after she got fired? Why didn't she complain?
Why didn't she complain? Really?
He means the anonymous hotline.
There's a hotline?
Yeah.
I did the harassment seminar twice. I never heard about a hotline.
They have a contractual right to monitor our communications. A hotline in this building is like a complaint box in occupied Paris. It's like we're telling women, go on, speak up for yourself. Just know the entire network is with Roger. No one will believe you. They'll call you a liar. Oh, and as for your career, you want assignments and airtime? Go ahead, call the paranoid man who decides your salary a pervert and do that on an anonymous hotline he controls. On a phone, he has a contractual right to record. Do you think women are idiots? It's like somebody stripped you naked and they want you to walk through this office just to prove it.
Okay. Can I see you for a minute?
Charlize Theron, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your performance in the film. I'm guessing you're pretty conflicted about Megyn Kelly and her role in, you know, political culture. On the one hand, I'm sure you admire her for speaking out about Roger Ailes. On the other hand, I would imagine you disagree with her politics. So what was it like for you to play her with that kind of conflict in mind?
Yes, you're very correct in that statement. We're very different women. We have different, I think, points of view on a lot of issues, and she has definitely said things in the past that I've had issue with, that I took issue with. But the focus really was to tell the story of what these women at Fox, I mean, I think the cast of characters are so unusual that this story came from that world, from them. A lot of these women have been somewhat hypocritical when it comes to sexual harassment and have made statements about sexual harassments that have not necessarily been about really bettering the workplace for women or just for women in general. All of that was so unusual for me, but that really was the importance of the film and why I think we wanted to make it. And once I zeroed in on that, and I found space in the film for us to show Megyn with some of those issues, I felt like that was a true representation of not just her, but I think of the world of Fox and what they kind of send out into the world.
You get Megyn Kelly's voice, I think, perfectly. And so let's hear her speak for a minute. And this is from, like, her most famous broadcast moment in 2015 during the first Republican presidential debate that was hosted by Fox News. And she asked a now famous, challenging question to candidate Trump that led him to tweet after very disparaging things about her, including that she had blood coming out of her wherever. So here's Megyn Kelly asking a question to Trump at the debate.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account.
Only Rosie O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. Your Twitter account.
Thank you.
For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?
Okay, that was Megyn Kelly in 2015. I have to say, and I talked to Megyn Kelly about this when I interviewed her, it's just chilling to hear the audience kind of applauding when he's mocking Rosie O'Donnell and kind of mocking the whole idea of, you know, disparaging women. But anyways, what I wanted you to be listening for is her voice so that you could tell us what you hear when you hear her voice that you knew you wanted to pick up on in portraying her.
Her voice is very distinctive. She speaks in this very deep register. I sound like I have a deep voice today, but it's because I'm a little under the weather. I actually don't have a very deep register, and so that was a very difficult thing to kind of get as low as she goes. I actually stressed my vocal cords so much that I couldn't speak for 3 weeks in pre-production.
So this is just in rehearsing you stressed your voice?
Yeah, yeah, just practicing her sounds.
You sound to me like you do not have an accent. You sound like you were born in America. You grew up in South Africa on a farm. Describe the farm for us.
Well, it's what we call in South Africa a small holding. And so it was around, I think, 25, 30 acres. My parents bought the land because they had a road construction company and they needed the land for all the machinery, all the graders and rollers. So we lived off the land, but it wasn't an agricultural farm, but we survived off that farm. My mom once a year would slaughter a cow and we would fill 4 freezers with that meat. And that was what we lived off. And all of our vegetables and fruit came from what we grew on the land. And so I had that kind of earthy experience while my parents ran this business, this road construction business.
So you grew up during the apartheid era.
Yeah.
Were you exposed to Black people during that era? I mean, it was apartheid. I don't know if you even came in contact with people who weren't white.
So on our farm, all of the workers, everybody who worked in the company, and it was a pretty substantial company, all lived on the farm. So my whole childhood, I was raised with Khoisas and Zulus and South Sotus and all different cultures. Their children were raised with me on the property, and I considered them my family. I didn't really, you know, there was some isolation in the sense that we weren't really around in a lot of the big cities, that I really understood fully what was going on as a child, as a young child. The information that I really got about what was happening came from my parents. This was conversation that was always kind of whispered around when you went to the neighbor's house. People were always talking about politics, about elections, about all of these issues. So I had that awareness, but I lived in an environment where that wasn't how my family treated any of those people. I slept with a lot of those families. They babysat for my mom. If they went out somewhere, I would stay with them. And so it was only until I was 12 that I or 13 that I went to an art school in Johannesburg, where I really got to witness firsthand absolutely the atrocities of apartheid.
What were you taught about race in school?
Oh, history was leaning very much into our white history. The heroes of our story, of our founding fathers, were all white. And even though very much like I find our culture, this climate that we're in right now, with our polarizing political views in this country, it was very similar in South Africa. I had friends who had family whose father would be for apartheid. And once they found out that, you know, Black people lived on our farm, wouldn't let me come over for a sleepover. And so there was a distinction in that not everybody was living this way, but that it was very much thought of as people felt very strongly about it, and then other people didn't feel and thought that there was a reason to fight this. You know, I always wonder what my life would have been like if I grew up in one of those families. If I was just an innocent child who was born into the family who, like one of my friends, who believed that apartheid was the right way of life. I was just incredibly blessed that I was raised by, you know, especially my mother, who I was really kind of raised by a single parent. My father wasn't around that much, but by a mother who was just aghast by all of this. I didn't really truly understood, I think, what any of this really did to me as a young child until I was in my mid-30s and I went to therapy for the first time because of a relationship that was failing. And what I discovered while in therapy trying to save my relationship was that I had a lot of trauma from being a young child growing up in South Africa during the apartheid era.
And can you tell us more about the trauma for you and what you figured out later about how you as a white person, as an empowered person, were traumatized by apartheid?
That's a lot to reconcile with when you realize that you benefited under a administration, a nation, a country, because you had the right skin color. I benefited, my life was more comfortable because of the suffering of a lot of people who just by chance were born in the wrong skin color. And that is a lot, that was a lot for me to carry. It still is. It is, I think it's something that I'll carry for the rest of my life.
How old were you when you left and why did you decide to leave then?
I left 3 weeks after I turned 16. I won this modeling contest, and one of the prizes was a trip to Italy with a modeling contract. And my mom was just incredibly encouraging of me going. She felt like it was a great opportunity for not only, you know, the possibility of, you know, finding maybe something that would interest me or a life abroad or being able to, like, travel. I had never been on a plane. I had never seen anywhere. We had never traveled before. We drove, you know, to Durban in our car for 6 hours every holiday. So I think there was this moment that coincided with the political turmoil at the time. This was in 91. And she said, you should really take this opportunity. And that's why I left. I felt really bad. My father had passed away just a few weeks earlier. And I didn't want to leave her alone. She was going through a lot. And she really kind of like pushed me out of the nest. And she said, you have to take this opportunity. It was an incredible selfless moment that she gave me as a mother.
You mentioned your father passed away. This is a part of the story that I know you don't, I think you might not want to talk about. So I'll just mention what happened and you can tell me if you'd like to talk about it or if you'd prefer not to. Your father came home drunk one night and shot at you and your mother. She got her gun and shot and killed him. And that's how he died. I don't know if you're comfortable talking about that or
yeah.
Not.
Okay. No, yeah, no, I am. I think a lot of my, just the any reluctancy that anybody has ever heard is just that this is usually the headline that people walk away from. And I think what's frustrating is that the trauma around having an experience like that, of course, is quite surreal. And but it's more the fact that, you know, my father was a very sick man. My father was an alcoholic all my life. I only knew him one way, and that was as an alcoholic. And South Africa at that time was not necessarily a place where there was any, that you didn't have access to any kind of support group where you could even acknowledge that this was a problem or go and find help. Our culture at the time was very much that of like, well, this is what men do. Men drink. And if you're a strong man and a good man, you drink a lot. And it was a pretty hopeless situation. Our family was just kind of stuck in it. And the day-to-day unpredictability of living with an addict, is what is, I think, the thing that you sit with and have kind of embedded in your body for the rest of your life, more than just this one event of, you know, what happened one night. I think our family was an incredibly unhealthy one, and all of it, I think, scarred us in a way. And of course, you know, I wish what happened that night would have never happened. It's unfortunately what happens when you don't get to the root of these issues. My father was so drunk that he shouldn't have been able to walk when he came into the house with a gun. And he shot through. My mom and I were in my bedroom leaning against the door because we thought he was trying to push through the door. And so both of us were leaning against the door from the inside to have him not be able to push through. And he took a step back and just shot through the door three times, and none of those bullets ever hit us, which is just a miracle. But in self-defense, she ended the threat.
Did you think that you and or your mother would die
that night? Yes. No. I really believe that was it. Yes.
So what do you do after a shooting like that? Did you call the police?
Your body goes into automatic, and in a strange way, I just remember my mom saying, "You have to run to the neighbors. You have to run to the neighbors." And I was in my pajamas. I was barefoot, and I just remember I just ran in complete darkness, and I could hear my breath. I just remember my breath felt so amplified in my ears as my feet were hitting the dirt road as I was trying to get to the neighbor's house. But I think she wanted to get me out of the house. I think she was still, in that moment, she was being a mother. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. And she was trying to get me out of the house. And I felt like I left her in the threat that she was still in danger. Mm-hmm. But the neighbors kept me at their house. She came to get me about an hour later. And up until that point, I didn't know that he was dead. I had no idea that he was dead. And so it wasn't, you know, I think that was, you just kind of like find yourself in this like continuous motion of shock.
Mm-hmm. How do you mourn your father when your father tried to kill you and your mother? I mean, what is that mourning process like? Did you feel any grief?
You know, for me, it was a long one. My mom was incredibly strong. I feel like she knew that she had to be that for both of us. But she didn't deny me the room to mourn. And I remember one night we were staying with my aunt, and I was in the bath, and she was just sitting with me on the side of the bath, and I started getting really emotional. But I didn't want to show her because I didn't want her to feel bad. And I just remember her saying to me, "It's okay, it's okay." And so, you know, I think we did what we had to do, and she allowed me to kind of grieve in a different way than she was grieving. And I think for her, she was stuck in the consequences of that night for another 3 years of her life, because there was a lot of unfortunate things that happened after that she was still in the middle of. And
legal things, or?
Yeah, yeah. And
I should mention, she was acquitted self-defense, so.
Yes, yeah. This was mostly my father's side of the family who just unfortunately really unfairly went after her. And I have never since talked to any of those family members since that happened.
I'm thinking about how strong your mother was, that she, you know, because you just told her she encouraged you to leave after you won the modeling competition and to go to Italy and to be abroad and maybe stay abroad. And considering what she was going through after that, that just seems like so strong of her and so protective of you and showing such love for you.
It's incredible. You know, now that I have my own two daughters, and I just even trying to wrap my head around that idea of what she did, it's tremendous what my mother did. And the gift that she gave me, I've said this a million times, I would not be here today if it wasn't for her selfless decision to really push me out of that nest and say, go, you have to take advantage of this.
Well, she prevented you from being the daughter of the woman who shot her father.
Yeah, I mean, she is very
much... Because no one would know when you went to Italy. No one needed to know about that.
Nobody knew. Nobody knew for really, I mean, nobody knew until somebody found the story. I, for years, just never shared the story with anybody.
When did your mother move to the U.S.?
She's been living here full time for the last 14 years, 15 years.
You're very close now.
Yeah, physically and emotionally. Yes, I mean, she lives like 2 minutes away from me. And she co-parents with me. And she's a huge part of raising my girls. And, you know, she is just a really cool person. If she wasn't my mother, I would still be this close to her. Like, I just think that she is like no one I have ever met in my entire life. She is a broad. She is a lover of life. She appreciates things on a level that is just so lovely to be around. You know, she wakes up every morning at 5 a.m. and she hikes for 3 miles with not only her dogs, but my dogs, and will send me every morning a photo of the sun coming up.
And, so great.
You know, and yeah. That really sums up who my mom is.
Well, Charlize Theron, I want to thank you for sharing some of your life with us. And mm-hmm. I congratulate you on your performance in Bombshell and your Screen Actors Guild nomination for Best Actress. Thank you so much for coming to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Charlize Theron stars as Megyn Kelly in the new film Bombshell. Last year, women artists took 7 out of 10 spots on rock critic Ken Tucker's top 10 album list. This year, women took over completely, filling all 10 slots. Ken says that from rap to rock to singer-songwriter pop, 2019 was a bountiful year for all kinds of music. Here's a song from one of the artists on his list, Lizzo, who was just nominated for 8 Grammys.
Feelings, yo. Once upon a time, I was a hoe. I don't even want a hoe no more. Got you something from the liquor store. Little bit of Lizzo and some mo. Trying to open up a little mo. Sorry if my heart a little slow. I thought that I didn't care. I thought I was loving bad. But baby, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I'm crying cause I love you.
When I started drawing up my 2019 best list, it was quickly apparent that the first 3 entries would be in very close competition. I love Lizzo's album 'Cause I Love You for its soul ballads and hip-hop funk. I admire Billie Eilish's When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go for its artful intimacy, and I continue to be nourished by Lana Del Rey's Norman Effing Rockwell for its long, languid songs about the ways that men intrigue, please, and disappoint her. In the end, Del Rey's cinematic compositions pushed her collection just slightly ahead of the others to take the number 1 slot.
I miss Long Beach and I miss you, babe. I miss dancing with you the most of all. I miss the bar where the Beach Boys would go. Dennis's last stop before Kokomo. Those nights were on fire, we couldn't get higher. We didn't know that we had it all. But nobody wants you before the fall.
Greatest loss of them all. Other artists on my best list are adored within their genres, but are perhaps less well known to a wider listenership. Megan Thee Stallion's debut album, Fever, collected her witty, profane thoughts. Carly Rae Jepsen's Dedicated offered a whole new set of dance pop confections. And I was completely won over by the album full of tough-minded songs written and performed by Carsey Blanton on Buck Up, which I have no doubt is the most underrated album of this year.
I was once an American kid, growing up on hollowed ground. Rode to the river on a pretty red horse in a pretty little country town. But I grew up fast and I cast my vote for the president. And I had my doubts, but I still had hope until I read the finer print. Don't look now, but it won't be long.
Of course, men made great music as well, frequently in the form of a different measurement of artistic achievement, the hit single. Does anyone doubt, for example, that the song of the year is Lil Nas X's Old Town Road? It's the song that defined the year for its massive, genre-crossing popularity and sheer catchiness. And if I had to narrow it down to one favorite song in 2019, it was probably this one, 21 Savage's musical list of trials and tribulations called A Lot. In the end, I narrowed it down to these 10 albums. Number 1, Lana Del Rey's Norman Effing Rockwell. 2, Lizzo, 'Cause I Love You. 3, Billie Eilish, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? 4, Carsey Blanton's Buck Up. 5, Megan Thee Stallion, Fever. 6, Carly Rae Jepsen, Dedicated. 7, Maren Morris's Girl. 8, Beyoncé, Homecoming, the live album. Sharon Van Etten's Remind Me Tomorrow is number 9, and 10 is Jenny Lewis's On the Line. It was also a very strong year for women writing music books. A fine new biography of Janis Joplin by Holly George Warren, Deborah Harry's eccentric autobiography, Karen Tongson's critical study titled Why Karen Carpenter Matters, and the best rock memoir I read all year, Amy Rigby's Girl to City. Yes, as far as I was concerned, it was the year of the woman, and it was exhilarating. My best to you for this holiday season.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. You'll find his 10 best list, as well as book critic Maureen Corrigan's 10 best list, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, we hear from Julie Andrews. She has a new memoir about her Hollywood years. We'll also talk with her daughter, theater director and writer Emma Walton Hamilton, who co-wrote the book. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
With songs they have sung for a thousand years.
My guests are Julie Andrews and her daughter Emma Walton Hamilton, who collaborated with Andrews on her second memoir called Homework, which was just published. Translated, Emma is the daughter of the woman known for being the most perfect governesses imaginable, Mary Poppins and Maria in The Sound of Music. Andrew's first memoir was about growing up in London when it was being bombed during World War II. When the war was over, she became part of her mother and stepfather's vaudeville act and went on tour with them, eventually becoming the star of the act. Then it was on to Broadway, where she starred in My Fair Lady and Camelot. The new memoir, which covers the years 1963 to 86, begins when she moves to Hollywood to start work on Mary Poppins, just a few months after Emma was born. In addition to describing her movie career, she writes about her marriage to set and costume designer Tony Walton, Emma's father, and her second marriage to Blake Edwards, who directed Andrews in several films, including Darling Lily, The Pink Panther Strikes Again, Ten, and Victor Victoria. The book is also about being a mother to Emma, the two children from Blake Edwards' first marriage, and the two Vietnamese children Andrews and Edwards adopted. Emma Walton Hamilton has co-written 32 books with her mother, mostly children's books. Along with her husband, she co-founded the Bay Street Theater Company in Sag Harbor, Long Island, which she co-directed for 17 years. Julie Andrews, Emma Walton Hamilton, welcome to both of you, and congratulations on the book. I really enjoyed it. Since the book begins, Julie, with you going to Hollywood to make Mary Poppins, and I say it begins, this is after the opening chapter in which you sum up the first part of your life that you told in your first memoir. So let's start with you going
exactly.
Let's start with you going to Hollywood. After Walt Disney saw you on Broadway in the musical Camelot, he asked you to star in Mary Poppins. But you had just gotten pregnant with Emma, so what did you tell him?
Well, I told him just that, Terry. I said, oh, Mr. Disney, it's wonderful, and thank you so much for the invitation to come and hear the music and see your wonderful designs and drawings, but I'm afraid I'm pregnant. And he said, oh, that's okay, we'll wait. And I didn't realize, of course, at the time, having never made a movie, and I'd been to Hollywood to visit, but only once worked there on a television show, but certainly hadn't ever made a movie. So I had no idea how long pre-production on a movie takes. He said, okay, we'll wait, and he did. And 9 months later, or 10 months later, when Emma was born, my first husband, Tony Walton, and I traveled to Hollywood and were welcomed into the heart of the Disney studios and lovely people, and couldn't have been more spoiled. The amazing thing is that my husband at the time, Tony Walton, who was a designer, was asked by Walt to bring his designs with him so he could see them. And when he did see them, he hired Tony on the spot to do the costumes and the interiors, mostly, of Mary Poppins, the film. Talk about a phenomenal break for this married couple with our new baby and a job for both of us. And Tony got a wonderful Academy Award nomination for that.
So how many months after you gave birth did you have to start rehearsing dance scenes?
Well, we did, all the rehearsals for the choreography and for the pre-recording that had to be done of the songs, and costumes had to be fitted. It was about 3 months before we traveled to Hollywood, and then about 4 or nearly 5, I think, before we actually began shooting.
Did your body feel ready? Because it's a very it's a very physical role, also considering you were flying.
Yes. Well, it didn't feel ready. I mean, having just had a baby, it took me a while to get in shape the way I felt I should be. There was an enormous amount of action in every way. I would, work out every day. And of course, as I said, there were the dances to learn, which were pretty active. And I didn't feel ready, but I guess I was.
Emma, let's bring you into the conversation. Do you remember the first time you saw your mother in Mary Poppins?
What I remember, Terry, one of my earliest memories is not actually seeing the film, but being in a department store, in a children's clothing section of a department store. And I think I was about 3 years old, and it must have been right around the time the film came out, because it took so long in post-production after the film was shot for them to finish all the special effects and so forth and the animation. And I was with my nanny at the time, and they had set up a display for Mary Poppins in the children's section of the department, and there were all these life-size cardboard cutouts of my mom. And I remember pointing to them and saying, look, there's Mummy. and then suddenly becoming aware of two women who were shopping in the department next to us saying to one another, isn't that sweet? That little girl thinks her mother is Mary Poppins. And I was like, but she is. That's her. That's my mom, you know. And I think that was the first time I understood that my mom's job was perhaps a little different.
A little public, that's yeah. for sure, yes.
Emma, what was it like for you to know people who, like, worshipped your mother because of the movies? And I'm talking about when you were young and you were a child yourself. And they thought of your mother as, you know, Maria in The Sound of Music or Mary Poppins in Mary Poppins as basically like the perfect governess who could like soothe any child, make any child like see the silver lining of any cloud. And you know,
if only they knew how hard I was struggling, Terry,
right.
as a real mom.
Yeah, yeah. So Emma, what was it like for you to see this like Hollywood version of, you know, of your mother's role versus like, what it was like in real life?
Well, it was challenging sometimes, as you can imagine. A lot of times people would ask me questions or assume, you know, does she sing you to sleep at night and things like that.
Did she?
It always baffled me. No.
Well, certainly not,
those songs anyway. Yeah. You know, one doesn't generally bring one's work home if one can help it. And when she sang to me, it was usually, you know, English lullabies and old English songs from vaudeville days that, you know, harked back to her youth. And later, we moved around a lot because of her work taking her to various different parts of the world. And so as a result, I went to a number of different schools. I think I went to about 7 different schools over the course of my childhood. And that was interesting because I finally found that if people found out who my mother was, they would tend to sort of want to be friends in order to get an invite over to the house kind of thing. So I learned to hide behind the name Walton, which was my maiden name and is my father's name, for as long as I possibly could, so as to cultivate hopefully some real friendships before any of the other stuff became
It sounds so
part
sad,
of the relationship.
Darling. Oh.
It wasn't sad, actually.
It was all you knew, really.
Yeah, just was what it was. And the truth is, Mom was very, very family. As people who read the book will see, you know, family means everything to her. You know, she was a mom through and through at home and always made an effort to get up and make breakfast for us before school in the mornings, even if she had a full day at the studio or was night shooting, and, you know, really worked hard to create a family routine and atmosphere at home that was real and normal and separate and apart from all the other stuff of Hollywood. So it was a bit of a contrast to what people, I think, imagined.
And films are episodic. Therefore, you know, there was acute work sometimes and then some long periods between a movie when one was just home and being mum.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel, Julie Andrews, did you feel pressure to measure up to Mary Poppins and to Maria in The Sound of Music, to be perfect, to be a solution to your children's problems?
Not at all, Terry, and I'm far from that. But I did feel pressure to be as good a mum as I could because I was aware of, let's say, other people in the business who had issues with family and work and their children did suffer. And I didn't want that. I wanted us to be a family. And of course, it was doubly hard because, sadly, my first marriage ended to Tony, although we're still great, great friends. And finally, I remarried Blake Edwards, the film director, and I was making a new family as well.
Emma, but what was it like for you when first you had a blended family with two siblings from Blake Edwards' first marriage and then two adopted children? And, I mean, let's face it, your mother's time was divided among more children.
It was, and my time was divided between both my parents as well. So I
who were living on opposite coasts.
opposite coasts, exactly. Or even, I mean, there were years when we were living in Europe and my father was in New York. My father was always in New York. And so I spent the school year with my mother and Blake and my stepbrother and sister and then my younger sisters. And all of the summer vacations and Christmas and Easter vacations and school breaks with my father and my stepmother and my stepsister. And they were very different households. They were very different cultures. They were in different cities. And it was an interesting experience. I found quite often that while I was traveling between homes on the airplane, let's say, I would go through a process of, in a way, adapting myself into the daughter that I needed to be to fit into that house. It's not painful. It just was what it was. It was like, okay, now I have to be the daughter that is hip to New York and, you know, the theater scene and all of that. And now I'm going back to California or I'm going to London or Switzerland and I have to adapt to being the other daughter, the school-based daughter and the daughter in the larger family and so forth. It was interesting.
Julie Andrews, you were a professional as a child. You toured with your mother and stepfather in their vaudeville act. Your early years were during World War II, and then you toured in their vaudeville act. So you were, and then you were making more money than they were, and then you ended up being top billed in the vaudeville act because you were such a great singer. But, you know, you were working. You were the earner in the family when you were a child.
I was just a stage brat. And I think one of the reasons I really enjoy it when I'm working because I've worked my entire life. I mean, to the point where I really wasn't attending school. I had to have a tutor that came and worked with me. But I would love to have attended university. And I had a very rarefied and rather pitiful education in a way. My mother said to me, oh, you'll get a much better education from life out there. And to a certain extent, I did. But I was always scrambling to catch up on history or things that really fascinated me.
Julie, you started psychoanalysis after you were mm-hmm. in a committed relationship with Blake Edwards. And I can't remember if this is before or after you were actually married. But basically, the way you describe
before,
when you started psychoanalysis, it's like a dam opened up. I mean, you just started like weeping. and I'm wondering if you felt you had to hold in a lot of feelings and just be strong and not show any vulnerability because, one, you grew up during the war years. You were living in London during World War II when you were getting bombed all the time. And you were going in and out of bomb shelters. You were blowing a whistle and literally warning people when the planes were coming when you were a child. And then you're a child and you're touring with your parents in vaudeville performing, and the show must go on no matter what. So did that kind of teach you to just, like, hold everything in?
Yes, absolutely. Whatever it was that I'd been being stiff upper lip about in my youth. And I did take care of most of my family in every sense, financially and emotionally, because we were, you know, my stepfather was alcoholic and it was not an easy situation, but...
Well, something else you
thank
had to hold
for
in.
Therapy.
Yeah, I mean, another thing is, and we talked about this during our first interview, your stepfather... when he would get really drunk, he could be abusive, and he was drunk a lot. And
yes.
A couple of times, he came into your bedroom and tried to kiss you. Mm-hmm. It didn't go further than that, but that's very bad.
Yeah. I don't know how. Yeah, I mean, whatever measure of decency was left in him when he was, drunk, he refrained from going any further. But, well, it was pretty scary, and when it could have been just disastrous, but I was very fortunate in the sense that I survived all that. But there was a lot that I needed to sort out in my head, and the failure of my first marriage, which hurt a lot, and I wasn't sure about anything. And the wonder is that my wonderful therapist suddenly realized that what I craved probably more than anything was an education. And so being a Merlin-like personality, he decided to give me one. And I got so many answers in terms of some of the things in life that I needed to learn. And it was a phenomenal experience for me.
So Blake Edwards became your husband, but he also directed you in several films. He directed you in S.O.B., which was a satire of Hollywood, in 10, which was a romantic comedy, Victor Victoria, in which
About midlife crisis
for the men. Yeah. Victor Victoria, which you played a woman impersonating a man in drag. He saw you really differently than the preconception that people had of Julie
I guess
Andrews.
That having me as a wife and us sleeping together and being a great, we were married, we knew each other 44 years before he sadly passed away, but he was somebody that knew me very, very well, and I think I knew him very well. This was a marriage that lasted, and it was complicated and wonderful and quite magical at times, and he was the most mercurial, talented, attractive man, and it was quite an experience to be married to Blake Edwards, believe me.
But, I mean, just getting back to him directing you, you were topless in one scene in one of his films. you know, there's a lot of, like, gender... gender stuff going on in Victor Victoria. So
yeah, it's very daunting, Terry, when your husband says in a love scene that you're doing with your leading man on camera, he says, well, that's fine, darling, but I know you can do it better. And it's rather difficult in the film studio when you're filming it.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Julie Andrews, Emma Walton Hamilton, thank you.
Thank you. We are such great, great fans of
yours.
Yes, we are.
It's
such a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really been my pleasure to talk with you both. Julie Andrews and her daughter, Emma Walton Hamilton, collaborated on Andrews' new memoir called Homework. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.